It's my pleasure to introduce our last speaker of the semester, Dr. Constantine Kuras. He's retired from the presidency of the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, a position he held for almost 10 years. He was the fourth chief of executive of that organization. He's a Kentucky native and has served as president of three universities, Murray State for 10 years, the University of Northern Iowa for 12 years, and Clemson University for over 4 years. He's an advocate for public higher education and students and a proponent for qualitative strengthening of our learning. He's been appointed to many commissions related to education. He received his baccalaureate and doctorate degrees from the University of Kentucky, and we won't hold that against him. And he has a master's degree from the University of Illinois. Go on. It's my pleasure to welcome the chairman of our Murray State University Board.
Is it all right if I speak from here?
Absolutely.
I've got some notes, so I don't want to. Well, this is a group that's a glutton for punishment. To be out on a day like this with what's portended to come to hear me speak. So I'm flattered, but for many of you, I am sort of having a question or two about your sanity. But I appreciate the kind introduction. It's been my experience that anytime anyone who's been in the presidency gets nice comments from the faculty regent, you accept them gladly and remember them fondly. This is going to be sort of an informal presentation in ways. From what Renee indicated, the purpose of this series is to talk about life experiences and to make it more personal than professional, and to leave the opportunity for any questions or any comments that people wish to make. And so if that's agreeable, I'll spend a little time speaking, and then you can rebut anything I say, or if you have any questions, I'm really glad to respond to them. Since my days as president, eyesight has failed a little bit, so if you will pardon me, I'll put my glasses on. I feel very fortunate to have had a career that has fulfilled a passion of mine. Not everyone has that opportunity. My passion has always been providing high-quality educational opportunities. Believed in it. I think it has sustained me in difficult times. But I must admit, I never planned to go into higher education. As an aspiring political scientist, I envision myself in public administration. And sometimes now, as I look at people in public administration, I say to myself, what were you thinking? But that's what I wanted to do. And my master's thesis at the University of Illinois focused on state welfare administration in Kentucky. And that scholarly endeavor on my part was intermingled with minimum wage work with juvenile delinquents at the Barkley State Boys Camp near Kentucky Dam Village. So that's where I came from. Then one day, out of the blue, a friend who had been appointed president of Midway College, which at that time was a junior college for women in Midway, Kentucky, asked me to come and help him out. And I said, doing what? And he said, well, I'm not sure. But I've got this new job and I just need some people to help me out. And I said, why not? And that began my odyssey in higher education, an odyssey far different than I had envisioned or studied for. Now that was 50 years ago, and my unexpected journey has given me immense fulfillment. Today, I remain passionate about the power of education and the importance of public service. Now, to give you a little perspective on that, let me indicate to you that my father immigrated to this country from Greece, and particularly from the island of Crete, when he was 15 years old. He was part of a great immigration around the turn of the 20th century, of individuals who came to this country to work because there was opportunity to work and make money and then go back to your home country. But for my benefit, he decided to stay in America, even though the rest of his family all lived on the island of Crete. With only a third grade education, his options were limited, but he made a good living and was a good parent. My mother grew up in Canada, particularly in the western provinces. Her education was cut short in the 10th grade, as her family, like many other families, struggled to survive in the Great Depression. My parents met in Lexington, married, and settled there, where my younger sister, and she would insist that I indicate she is younger, were born and reared. And she too went the route of education, having served as a high school English teacher in Florida and then two schools in northern Kentucky, Simon Kenton and Dixie Heights. So I lived in Lexington, though my high school years were spent just north of there, where I graduated from Grant County High School, which is located in the robust community of Dry Ridge, Kentucky. Jo, my wife, and I live in Lexington, not far from where my parents resided and where I grew up. But between the Lexington of my youth and the Lexington of a senior citizen, I spent 5 years in West Virginia, 10 years here in Murray, a dozen winters in Iowa, another 5 years in Clemson, before moving to the Washington, D.C. region, where I led an association of over 400 public colleges and universities for a decade before my retirement. I am now engaged in part-time consultative work, annually helping one or two universities search for new presidents, and also assisting governing boards in presidential evaluations. I've just returned from Michigan, where I'm assisting a university of nearly 11,000 students, Saginaw Valley State, search for a new president. In the week before Thanksgiving, at the behest of the governing board, I conducted a comprehensive performance review of the president of West Virginia State University. And as you are all aware, another chapter in my journey opened in 2009, when once again, out of the blue, Governor Steve Beshear called me and asked me to serve as a regent at Murray State University. So here I am today. Well, those are the stops along my journey, but they're not the journey itself. So I'm going to take a few moments and talk about three momentous events that shaped not only my journey, but also my life. All three events occurred when I was in my 20s. The first event that shaped my journey occurred when I was 21 years of age and just having graduated from college. My father took the family back to the old country, and specifically to the mountain village where he grew up and where aunts and uncles and some 15 first cousins still reside. We were looking forward to that trip, to see where my father came from. I was a little surprised when I came to the village. There was no electricity there, no refrigeration, no lights. There was no running water, though the women of the village were excited that a well had been dug, and now they no longer had to walk down the mountainside to the creek in order to fill their jugs and then carry them back to the village. And another sign of progress had occurred. My Aunt Katina had the first outhouse in the village. Now, prior to the outhouse, folks just went out in the field. But now, she wanted us to stay with them because she had an outhouse. There was just one problem. The folks there just so loved the mountain views that they did not want to look at wooden planks, so they removed the door from the outhouse. For the first time, I understood what it meant live in America, how this country offered opportunities that many in the world would never realize. I looked at my cousins and recognized that they had the same genes that I had, but that I had opportunity and they did not. And that were it not for my father's courage to leave that village, and the grace of God that gave him a good life here, I would be growing up in that little village in Crete. I learned never to take good fortune for granted, and that life quality is really dependent on education and economic opportunity and hard work. The second key event occurred a few years later when, as a 27-year-old, I was fortunate enough to be selected to be part of an educational delegation, invited to go behind the Iron Curtain and visit the Soviet Union, Czechoslovakia, and East Germany in the heart of the Cold War. And in case you're wondering, visiting Russia in February would not be classified as a vacation. But the weather befitted our times. Our country in the 60s had been shocked by the deaths of President John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. We were mired in Vietnam in a war that was increasingly apparent we could not win. We were reeling from race riots, anti-war demonstrations, and an explosion of widespread drug usage. We were in turmoil. We had seemingly lost our way as a people or as a country. But those 3 weeks behind the Iron Curtain in that heavily controlled society where people could not go places, where there was always the presence police and military personnel, where people were generally subdued in what they said, where they went. Those days restored my faith in democracy and in government of the people, by the people, and for the people. I became confident that despite all our troubles in this country, a brighter day was ahead for all of us, because we as Americans would not accept the alternative. This conclusion was especially pronounced when, after our stay in Moscow, we went to Czechoslovakia, arriving at the very day that the communist puppet ruler Novotny had been forced to resign and the Spring Revolution took place. In fact, we were at the Pilsner Urquhart Brewery at the very moment that Novotny resigned. And they opened the taps, and closed the place down, and everyone celebrated. Though short-lived, before Soviet troops invaded the country and restored the communist dictatorship, that brief period of exhilaration among the Czech people was ample testimony to me that people yearned for what we had, freedom. And from that trip, I learned an important lesson that I remember even today, that the actions of governments do not necessarily reflect the will and wishes of their people. Evil countries are home to many good people. The third event that impacted my life occurred 2 years later when I was serving as the chief student affairs officer at Marshall University. On a rainy November night, a charter Southern Airlines plane carrying the Marshall University football team, coaches, boosters, student journalists, university officials, including the director of admissions, who reported to me and whom I encouraged to accept the invitation to travel with the team to this football game. That plane crashed on a West Virginia hillside, killing all 76 aboard. Those hours and days are still somewhat blurry to me. I recall that we sat up in the basketball arena, an emergency medical and counseling service for hundreds of distraught students. I also recall two staff members, the late Ted Morford and the retired Murray State Vice President and Professor Frank Julian, and I calling the parents of all the students who were on that plane. I recall as well the memorial service, which I helped plan. But the most overwhelming memory is the great emptiness that came and still comes with the death of those whose care has been entrusted to you. You know, throughout my presidential career, I've had to deal with a lot of adversity. And I felt I handled them as well as I could, except whenever we lost a student. I could never really handle that. These and a host of experiences at Marshall just drained me professionally and emotionally. And I accepted an invitation in the summer of 1971 to become vice president and dean of the faculty at West Virginia Institute of Technology. Despite its many challenges, I was happy to be back in the academic world. But my perspective on life really changed as a result of my years at Marshall, and particularly as a result of that airplane accident. During that time when I was at Marshall, I would on occasion date the daughter of the former lieutenant governor of the state, distinguished Murray State alumnus, Harry Lee Waterfield, for whom the Waterfield Library is named. So on several of occasions when I was at their home, Governor Waterfield would ask me, since I was in student affairs, how we handled a given demonstration, or why we did this, or why are the students upset over this? And I tried to give him best answer that I could, knowing at that time we really didn't know all that was behind the turmoil in our country, which of course came to bear on the campus where students then, and I presume now still, are the idealists in our society. Governor Waterfield was serving on the Murray State Board of Regents, as his son does today. And apparently, some of the same problems we had been facing at Marshall were here. And several of you were here at the time, so all I can tell you was what I was told. But highlighting those difficulties here was an invitation extended by some group, and I'm not sure whether it was student government or whom, to William Kunstler, who many of you know was a firebrand activist and an iconic anti-war critic. And he was sort of the emblem of the protest movement. And he was invited to come to speak at Murray State. But somewhere in the administration or the board, a decision was made to rescind that invitation so that he would not invite it here. And so at that time, Judge Robert O. Miller, who was the county judge executive, extended the invitation to Mr. Kunstler to come and speak at the courthouse square, which he did to a crowd far larger than would have ever been in this auditorium or anywhere else to hear him on the campus. This heightened the movement on here, at least that is what I was told. And the reason I mention that, the next part of the journey goes back to that. A year or so later, when I was at West Virginia Tech, once again, out of the blue, I received a phone call. And this was from Governor Waterfield. He told me that that President Sparks had informed the board, although it had not been publicly announced, that he would soon take retirement and that the board should commence with a new search for a president. And Governor Waterfield indicated he wanted me to apply. I did not apply and did not follow his suggestions. A few weeks later, he called again. And he wanted to know why I had not applied, as he had told me I should apply. And anyone who knows Governor Waterfield knows that there was never any doubt about what he wanted you to do. And I responded that I had no interest in being the president. And he quickly informed me that the board had no interest in my being the president. But that he wanted the board to meet me because Matt Sparkman, the vice president for student affairs, had retired, and that they needed to have a new vice president for student affairs. And after they chose a president, they were then going to choose a vice president for student affairs. And he wanted me to do that job. I really did not want to go back into student affairs, but rather than displeasing the governor, I followed through with a one-page letter. There was no resume, no attachment, just a one-page letter to the chairman of the board and chairman of the search committee, the late H. Glenn Doran. Just as he said, I was invited to come and interview to be president. So on the appointed day, I flew to Nashville, rented a car, was to meet with the board in the afternoon, stopped in Dover at the drive-in, grabbed lunch, a hot dog, on which they put plenty of mustard. You know the rest of the story. With the first bite, it was all over my white shirt. But I drove on to Murray, tried to clean up before my meeting with the board, had an enjoyable hour with them, just a friendly, open discussion, looked around the campus because I'd never been here before, and then headed back home, not thinking any more about the day. Unbeknownst to me, the board was split between two well-known candidates, the late Judge Robert O. Miller and the late Wells Lovett, the grandson of Murray State's founder and a distinguished regent here for several years. I was told that there were also a couple of board members who wanted neither candidate, but wanted an educator for president. I do not know what transpired. I was not there. All I know is what I was told later. And apparently, four regents indicated that they would prefer me to either of the two front runners. At this point, Governor Waterfield purportedly told the close associate, "I just need to get one more vote besides my own, and we can name the boy president." And the rest is history. Apparently, that is how I became Murray State's sixth president. I was named in June, but was told not to come to campus until August to give time for things to cool down. It took me a while to overcome my new moniker, as for several years, Harry Lee Waterfield had many friends down here, grew up in Murray, would call down here and would ask people, how's our boy doing? Having shared those thoughts, let me say that I've always admired Harry Lee Waterfield as a man of integrity and principle and really one of the truly great Kentuckians. And it's just with great pleasure that I serve on the board with his son. So that's how my journey brought me here and into the presidency, totally unplanned. I had not traveled on my journey alone. Joe and I married in 1974 and reared two children here at Oakhurst. And I believe our daughter, Elena, may be the only child born to a sitting president in Murray State. I'm not sure about that, but most of the other people who were presidents were much older than I was at the time. Joe is an attorney, practiced family law while we lived in Murray, and after completing an accounting sequence here on campus, and I don't know, Tim, if you had her in class, well, I hope she was a good student. I never wanted to ask you about that. She then completed a master's degree in taxation at the Emory School of Law. And when we moved to Iowa, she specialized in elder law, was an adjunct instructor at the University of Iowa, and has authored as primary author as well of an acclaimed reference book on elder law for the state of Florida. She now serves as an alumni trustee on the University of Kentucky Governing Board, which is sort of interesting, especially as we deal with the Crisp Center in Paducah. So, you know, I don't talk with her much about that. You know, if we decide to end that, they're stuck with the building and no income from us. But our marriage has survived worse, so. You know, our journey, like the treks of many other couples, has experienced moments of exhilaration as well as moments of sadness, both achievements and defeats, but in the main, the journey has been a joyous one, and we treasure our friendships across the country and beyond. I'm at a point now in my life where giving back is especially meaningful, and helping in some small way to shape the future of Murray State University is deeply fulfilling. We Regents take our role very seriously. We are not here to run the university. I had that opportunity for 10 years. I'm not interested in running it, and I don't know of any other regent that really wants to try and run the university. That's the role of the president, the administrative team, and the shared governance system that engages faculty, staff, and students in the important work of managing this great enterprise. Rather, we Regents represent the public's interest, serving as trustees of the assets of the university, both fiscal and physical, but most importantly, as trustee of the human assets who are the heart and soul of this university. All 11 Regents harmoniously work together, strive for consensus, but when disagreements occur, we try not to be disagreeable. Everyone is genuinely committed. From my point of view, without question, serving as a regent is not only an honor, but it is more so a sacred trust. So, that is my unexpected journey. A lot of things I left out, probably should have been left out. But in my life, as I suspect in yours, events largely beyond our control determine where we go, what we do, how we best serve our family and country. But also, each of us is entirely within our own control. As Aristotle once inscribed, know thyself. we are true to ourselves, to our values, if we always act with integrity, if we care about others, and if we are mindful of the trust that has been given us by family, friends, and fellow citizens, everyone's journey will be as fulfilling as mine has been. At this point, I'll let anyone say whatever they want, rebut anything I say, ask any questions. Nothing's off limits.
First, let's thank our speaker. Question. Yes, Dr. Brown.
Dr. Kirst, you've had a long and distinguished career in higher education. So what would you say is the most significant change that you've seen in higher education over your career, and any implications it might have for where you stay today?
I think the most significant change in higher education, as reflected on in front of me here, has been women. When I first became president in 1973, and I would go to any conference, the only women you would see in higher education administration were nuns. What has changed most dramatically has been the advance of women in positions in higher education, teaching, administration, executive, the great flow of women students into all careers. More women are now in law school than men. I think they're about 50-50 in medical school. Close to 60% of the students in higher education today are women, not men. That's been the most dramatic change. And in many respects, I think in the long run gives us as a society one of the greatest edges, edge over other societies to sustain our brilliance. The other major change, Ted, is not so pleasant. And that is the inordinate amount of debt students must undertake to get a college education today. The latest figures that came out said the average graduate this past year graduated with a debt of $29,400. That's average. Average student marries an average student. They start life together blissfully with nearly $60,000 in debt to the university. That's before a car, that's before a house, that's before anything else. And we're part of that problem. Those of us in higher education are part of the problem. We're not the biggest part of the problem. Politicians, state legislators, others have choked off funds to higher education. The federal government went for several years without fully funding Pell and created programs for student borrowing. Proprietary institutions charge tuition that is a combination of maximum Pell and the maximum amount a student can borrow. And magically you total those up and that comes pretty close to their tuition charges. So we have created a legacy that is very disturbing. So on the one side, there's great advancement to include all people in higher education. Minority groups, attendance is up. Women now dominate the academy. On the other side, we've saddled students with debt.
Other questions?
I'm not sure exactly how to word it, but in a way, I'm another one of those people that never really intended to be involved in higher education. It was a department chair at Western that kind of twisted my arm to accept a job at Western. But through the major events that you described, you really said that you didn't plan any of them. We've got a lot of young people here. Are you telling them not to, you know, prepare and plan? But it really is opportunities and set goals and make a decision about an opportunity that's presented to you based on the trust of the people doing it and based on your instincts and based on your faith and so on.
I would say probably two or three things there. By all means, prepare. But just know you're not sure exactly what you're preparing for. Follow your passions. The happiest people in life are people whose work embodies their passion. What they do is what they love. Try to understand, take advantage of your education. I'm a big believer in the core curriculum. I believe in that the more you know, the more you read, the more you engage in discussions, the more you understand, the better prepared you will be for whatever opportunities happen to come your way. So I'm a big believer in preparation. But I don't encourage people to be so narrow in their preparation that they're oblivious to other things that will occur in life and to understanding people that are different from them. I think take advantage of, I believe in inclusion, and take advantage of diversity in the sense that there are many different people, there are many different values, there are many different religions. They're all here on our globe. And the more that we know about other people, and other things, the better we will be as people, and greater the opportunities students will have in the future. That's a good point. Thank you.
So that role of positional leadership, our journeys have crossed paths many times. And I know that you play a modest, small role sometimes in a decision that's results don't come for years, often when you're not there any longer. And I wonder, as you reflect back over the story you told us, do you look now at things that you see that just you just love the fact that they happened, and maybe you see that you played a small, modest role in a decision early on? I see some of those now. Partly it's just getting older, but we prepare people for the future that we have to wait before we even know if what we did is effective. And I wonder if you reflect now about things you were involved in and how they've come to fruition and have been a joy to watch.
It's much easier to reflect on things where you think you were right as opposed to mistakes
you made. Just not with the goodness.
Yeah. And I think so here at Murray State as much as anything else, simply because serving as a regent, you're confronted and you see things that the germination, occurred several years ago. Bob and I go back to Northern Iowa, so followed each other's career, but for an example, I just take great pride, not any kind of personal aggrandizing, but just great satisfaction in how the American Humanics, now the Alliance for Nonprofit Leadership, the program here that is the largest in the country, how that began here. Some little way, I was involved in making sure that happened. And we had, oddly enough, Bob, I don't know if trying to get approval from what was then the American Humanics Board to start a program here was difficult. We had, they thought they needed to have just 16 campuses, and the idea that there'd be a 17th. But the challenges in life. So, yes, I think there's a great sense of fulfillment in seeing a lot of good things happen. And there are people in this room that were students when I was here. hold major positions at the university now. Take just great pride in seeing them succeed, and also take a lot of pride in some of the people that I was fortunate enough to attract to the university, Phil Bryan being one on the front row, that as much as anyone else helped to define Murray State as a student-centered university. I give him as much credit as anyone else. So.
Yes.
If I may, I think I've perhaps a beneficiary of that student-centeredness that you spoke of, and piggybacking off Bob's question. You have no reason to remember this, but 30-something years ago, as I was finishing up my undergraduate degree here, you invited me to your office for the purpose of encouraging me to consider going to graduate school. And at the time, I thought you were crazy. I had no use for that at all. And so I didn't follow your advice, and I didn't take it up. But I will say, planted the seed. And 3 years later, I was back in school. And I guess I just never forgot the encouragement. Just to know that someone had enough confidence and enough concern to call me aside and say, you ought to consider this. That was meaningful then, and I think we still have faculty and administrators here at Murray State that have that same interest, that take that same interest in the success of their students. I don't know that it meant anything to you, but it made a difference for me. And I think it still does for a lot of students over here. And so, thank you.
What do you do for fun? What are your hobbies?
I love to fish. I love to be out. I'm not a serious hiker, but I love that. I've really gotten into bird watching in later years. Some photography. I am a heritage gardener. I grow old-fashioned vegetables, particularly tomatoes, that are not hybrid. And in the wintertime, I read a lot.
Any questions?
I have a question. Okay. What was Murray State's initiative to attract so many international students, and what do you think international students bring to Murray State?
Murray State has attracted international students before I became president. And probably the more trying time, I think Jack and others can recall it, was when we had a large delegation of Iranian students here at the very time that the Iranian movement seized our diplomats and held them there for over a year. It was just a dreadful time. But there was great, people that remember this can understand the antagonism, the hatred that was throughout the country at that time about what had been done to our people. And we were sitting here with, I think, about close to 30 to 35 Iranian students. And, you know, one of the things that we did goes back to, you know, you have a sacred trust. The parents of the, I don't care whether they were for the Shah or against the Shah. Their being here put their lives and their futures in our hands. We had a sacred trust for their care and safety. So we made some arrangements, and in case there was any kind of effort, we had plans made on where we would take these students. And I mention that because international students have been a key part of this university. After my presidency, that expanded. And I was really grateful for that. And now we have students from far more countries. And one of the things that I've taken a lot of pleasure in, we see it again in the enrollment report that will be on the agenda for the board meeting tomorrow, that we've had an increase in international students here. Now, having said that, I feel very strongly that the educational benefits to American students to have an interaction with international students just cannot be overstated. Part of that reflects back when I talked about my visit to behind the Iron Curtain, to get to know people and to recognize the goodness in people, irrespective of what the leaders of a country may be clashing over, becomes embedded. And so I've been a very strong advocate of international education, and I'm really pleased to see it so prominent here. And where is your home country?
Belize.
Belize. I believe it was Jim Booth who led the initiative to expand our work in Belize. Is that? So,
thank you.
Very pleased.
Blake, do you have a question?
Yeah. So you were talking about being prepared for things you don't know you need to be prepared for. If I can get that out. But anyway, what do you think would be a way of preparing for something that you're not ready for, besides getting more education, besides your undergraduate?
Well, I don't want to sound as if I'm an academic dean. There's several in the room. But first of all, understand human nature, whether you get that through literature, whether you get that through psychology, or any host of history. Understand human nature. Understand what makes people tick. Then recognize and try to have as much, whether it's experience with international students, cross-cultural studies, try and have a clear understanding of how the rest of the world is. Then, quite obviously, and not because Renee Pfister is introducing me here, strengthen your mathematical capabilities, your understanding of the scientific method, and recognize that technology is exploding in ways that being well-versed in technology will probably give one as much advantage in the years ahead. So that's what I would recommend. Others may argue differently. But understand human beings, understand cultures and their differences, understand technology, and master the mathematical and scientific methods of inquiry. And that's what I would recommend. Having said that, neither of my children followed that advice.
And he has a final Tuesday morning, so he'll have more time. Dr. Bell.
When you left here, there was controversy concerning that, and I was wondering if that looked different between you now, 30 years later, than it did at the time.
Looking back at the controversy? Oh, no one really likes it. I'm sure there's some people who like them. I don't particularly like controversies. I would just say, Wayne, and my goodness, you chronicle things far better than I could recall them. I mean, it's amazing how well you chronicled all that. but what I would say, looking back on it, Murray State was in a transitional period. And I don't want to sound critical of anyone, but basically, during those time periods, in an effort to strengthen the academic enterprise of this university, which I think was then and remains today, that should be the number one priority, we moved to a university-wide system of hiring or appointing faculty and staff through searches. At the time I came, only Joe Prince in the College of Fine Arts at that time had an established search process for every open position. Standards for promotion and tenure. There was not a faculty senate at the time. The proposal had been given, and the faculty voted it down. And I asked Ms. Ruby, who was on the committee, why it was voted down. And she said, well, I was on the committee and we had a good proposal, but I voted against it. We didn't want it. Okay. So having said that, during that whole period of time, major changes in how the university would operate in the future were developed. Some were subsequently refined. But as I look at the whole issue of the controversy, I put it in the context of these were changes that were occurring. In the main, they were good changes for the university. But in the process, there was controversy. There were casualties, just like there are in any instance. And you'd like to say, boy, I wish I could go back and make every right decision and make sure that no one was unduly hurt. But you don't. Sometimes you just don't have that opportunity. You have to make decisions as you go along. But I feel very good about how the system wound up here. And you know, as you well know, it can be painful, it can be difficult, but in the end, right decision prevails. Is that correct?
I want to thank our speaker again.